We'll call the meeting to order, 7:03 PM. Can we stand for the Pledge Allegiance, please?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, liberty and justice for all.
Okay. Will clerk call the roll, please?
Mr. DiGiovanni?
Here.
Mr. Denise?
Here.
Mr. Harris?
Here.
Mr. Mizwitz?
Absent.
Mr. Kopchanski?
Here.
Mr. Sadlick?
Here.
Mr. Bartholomew?
He's absent.
Mr. Malerba?
Here.
Mr. Soika? Here. Record should reflect that you have five regular members and two alternate members present, Mr. Chair, so you have a quorum.
Thank you. Okay. Number four, additions, deletions, corrections to the agenda. I have none. Anybody else? No. Okay. Number five, communications. I have none. Ryan, are there any communications? Okay. Number six, public portion. Anyone from the public wish to speak? If there's anybody online that wishes to speak for the public hearing under 9A, you can hold your comments until we open that up. Is there anyone else from the public that wishes to speak?
I do, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Garfalo, town clerk. I want to speak regarding item number 11, informal discussion part of your agenda. I think that I asked the board to caution itself in the use of this informal discussion agenda on a regular basis because it does not allow the public access to know what is going to be discussed. In the past, it was always listed as informal discussion, and those discussions got pretty formal and pretty deep and detailed. And I think that if they're going to be put on here, there should be information that's made available to the public so that people know what they're talking about. The people on Bellevue Drive had a lot to say about that development when it went in, and it's very difficult for anybody to know what's going on. Then there's the issue of the convenience store on Olivia Street, where there's already tight parking, and it's a very difficult situation, and these things should be talked about on the merits and allowing people to know what it is exactly that's going on. So I would just ask for your caution on that, on item those kind of items on listed in item 11. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else from the public wish to speak? Is there anyone online, Mr. Garfalo, that wishes to speak with their hand up? If anybody on Zoom wish to speak, just unmute your mic and state your name and address for the record, please. If not, I'll ask if anyone from the public wishes to speak final time. We'll close the public portion. Okay. Public portion is now closed. We'll move on to item number seven, approval of minutes. Did everybody see the minutes from April?
Actually, no, I didn't.
Were they sent out or no?
I haven't seen any minutes.
All right. Can I get a motion to table?
I'll make the motion.
Second. Bill's got the motion. Do I have a second to table it?
A second.
Joe, all in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay, we'll put that on for next month. Number eight, receipts of applications. There are no new applications. And number nine, public hearing. 9A, Griffin Hospital, 130 Division Street, site plan modification application for modular building to be a permanent addition to Griffin Hospital to replace the magnetic resonance imaging, the MRI trailer on Spring Street, side of the hospital. Dominic?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Attorney Dominic Thomas, Cohen & Thomas, 315 Main Street, Derby, Connecticut, representing the applicant. I do want to confirm, have the two alternates been seated for this this public hearing and
we'll do that right now.
Okay.
So can I have a motion to set Oni Malerba and Joe Soika as members of the commission for this meeting? Do I have a motion?
I'm in.
David, second?
Second.
Raymond, all in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Well, obviously, we're not going to repeat the presentation we made. The last time there were certain issues that were addressed. We have a packet that was given. Hopefully, everybody has one that were a packet of 11 by 17s. There are also some full-size sheets. We provided a there was a question by, Member Sadlick concerning the existing covering, how they enter the trailer. We sent we gave you a photograph of that. There was, we give you a revised rendering of the building into an existing photo. And then we have a revised elevation to point out the materials that were requested at the last time. We had already given you a floor plan. There's no change in the floor plan. In addition to that, what I discovered afterwards, for example, as I explained to you, when we bring up all the copies, we simply give them to the building department, which has a bunch of zoning, building, fire marshal. And I discovered that the fire marshal had orally informed your staff that he had no issue with it. However, he was requested to do a writing, and I think he provided it, and I think it's been uploaded, Ryan. It's been uploaded. In addition to that, I was provided with a copy of email, I believe, from the chief of police. They were provided with the information because one of the requested, and I'll turn it over to the engineers. The requested documents that were related to the engineering was an intersection site distance plan and profile, which we submitted. Does everybody have the packet?
Yes.
I know some.
You have the view. Hold on, I'll get it for you.
Okay.
You got one? I've seen it. Yeah. You got one?
Yeah, like that.
So anyway, and they revised, well, they'll talk about it. We gave the requested survey of the area on which the site plan is based. The revisions to the existing condition and site demolition to show the existing connection from the trailer. And I will turn it over to them to discuss them. And we're here to answer any questions. I do want to point out that and I think I mentioned this briefly, but I wanted to highlight it. We had to file for a variance, which we did do, which required us to send out notices. Variance was approved. We had to, pursuant to your regulations, when we filed the application, a copy of the application was sent. And I think there's like 40 some odd mailings or something. We sent it again with a copy of the site plan. And finally, we had to do the notice of the public hearing. We sent it again. All told, for all of those mailings, I received one letter. Oh, I didn't receive a letter, I'm sorry. Planning and Zoning received a letter. When we did the ZBA variance, the individual called in question. He's the only individual who owns a house on Spring Street, that block that is not owned by Griffin Hospital, and he strongly supported the variance and the removal of the trailer in the permanent building because the comment he made was he doesn't like the trailer being moved and put back in again. And then I received a total of three calls, two of which were just, can you confirm why I got the letter? And I explained it. And the third one was, why did I get three letters? And I explained it. So those were the only calls I got in response to the public notice. And with that, I will Turn it over to Charles.
Dominic.
No, I'm sorry.
Dominic, just before you go, that letter was received and it's in the file.
What? Which one?
The letter from the property owner.
Nicholas D'Antona.
Yes, that's it. Yep.
I'm sorry, who? Either one. Whatever.
Good evening, members of the commission. For the record, my name is Andrew White, professional engineer registered in the state of Connecticut, representing Griffin Hospital tonight from Time Bond. As Attorney Thomas had mentioned, we provided an intersection site distance plan along Spring Street here. I believe the question that was raised at the last meeting was, as you have these loading docks that are facing south out to Spring Street, the MRI building will be on your left, which represents east, as someone is there, in fact, would be either pulling out or backing out. So we produced this intersection site distance to show at least 200 feet of clear distance to the intersection at Maple Street, so they can see from all these loading spaces. We took the loading space closest to the MRI, which would represent the worst case scenario. You get better site distance as you move west. So there's clearance for the intersection site distance from anyone rolling out of those loading ramps. The MRI building is not impeding on that at all, nor is any of the topography or any changes. As shown on the plans, the grading surrounding the MRI building is matching existing grades or being feathered. There's no obstructions at the ground level. So the building itself will not be impacting it, nor will any of the site development surrounding the building. I'd be happy to take any questions on that.
Is anyone?
I do have the sharing that plan on my screen for members of the public.
Are you sharing it now?
My mic not working, Mark? I'll agree for a second, then it's not.
Oh,
go ahead, try it now.
Just for the members, for the applicant and for the members and online, I am sharing my screen with the plan that Mr. White was referring to. Thank you.
Are there any questions from the commission?
Yeah, I just have one question, and it's not really a requirement. And the neighbor across the street doesn't seem to have any issue with changing the trailer out to the building. But you've got a fence in front of the building. Is there any possible way, this is more of a recommendation than a requirement, to maybe get some low-level landscaping along that fence?
I don't think there would be any I'll be discussing with the plans. Bring in some low level. Sight line, you know. I mean, I think the intention was brass, but we could talk about it. Certainly.
If you can.
Yes.
Any other questions? Thank you. You have anything else, Tom?
No, I think addressed in the presentations that we made, we addressed all of the questions that were raised at the last meeting. And like I said, you also wanted some reports, and there should be, I have them, I'm assuming you have the fire marshal's letter and the police chief's email.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay, if there's no other questions from the commission members, can I get a motion to
public?
Is there anybody from the public that wishes to speak on your 9A? Is there anybody online, Mark?
Gino, you got to turn your mic on.
Is there anybody online that wishes to speak for the public hearing for 9A? Could unmute your mic, speak now? No? Okay. With that being said, can I have a motion to close the public hearing? Joe?
Go ahead, Joe.
I'll make the motion.
Second?
I'll second it.
Bill, all in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay. We'll move on to 10A, old business. Griffin Hospital, 130 Division Street. site plan modification application for a modular building to be a permanent addition to Griffin Hospital to replace the MRI imaging trailer on Spring Street side of the hospital. Discussion, possible action.
Mr. Chair, I did draft a motion if you want me to read it into the record, but I'll let the commission speak first.
Is there any discussion? If not, go ahead, Brian.
That's a draft motion dated May 20, 2025 regarding Griffin Hospital MRI addition, 130 Division Street. Application for site plan approval on Assessor's Map 8-9, Lot 95. Motion, following review of the plans and supporting documentation submitted in support of this application, the Derby Planning and Zoning Commission hereby approves the site plan application for the Griffin Hospital and property shown on Derby Assessor's Map 8-9, Lot 95, subject to the following conditions. This approval shall be based upon the following documents submitted in support of this application. I'm not going to read all the documents, but I have listed 1 through 11, with item 4 being all the plans submitted. With the following stipulated conditions. 1, any modifications to the above referenced drawing shall be submitted to the Planning and Zoning Commission for review and action if necessary, including the placement of generators and or chiller units. 2, copies of the reference survey shall be submitted to the Zoning Enforcement Officer prior to issuance of a building permit. And I believe that's been done as part of the recently submitted package. So the only condition that I would have on this then is number 1. Number 2 can be stricken.
Okay. Can I get somebody to put that in the form of motion?
I'll make the motion.
Oh, with Ryan. Okay. Second?
I'll second it.
Bill, any discussion?
Yeah. I have a question, Roger.
Go ahead, David.
How does the revised site plan that I received a couple days ago address the parking situation with the new addition being put in? The fact that 5 parking spaces are being eliminated and the fact that the new addition has its own requirements for additional parking.
Well, at the last public hearing, Dave, I offered my opinion on the interpretation of the parking regulations with respect to hospitals, which is not defined in the parking regulations. There's only medical office building. And when you look at ITE,
right,
manuals, almost all examples of parking calculation for hospitals are based upon either bed count or employee count and not based on gross square footage like you would see in the zoning regulations for other other uses. I also offered my opinion that the spaces, I'm using air quotes for those online, that are being occupied by the site plan improvements were not general parking spaces. They were merely service-related parking spaces for hospital-related vehicles, loading spaces, things like that, and not spaces intended for the public, certainly, and not spaces intended for employees. So
they were marked staff parking.
Right. I think the testimony from the applicant was that those were parking for hospital-related service vehicles.
Now, Griffin Hospital has a site plan currently on file, and they use ITE parking calculations in order to arrive at that. I'm just wondering why that site plan information wasn't included in the site plan application.
I'm not aware of
this. This application simply ignores parking. And that's the problem that I have with it.
Okay.
You don't know why they didn't submit parking?
I discussed it with the applicant during the application process. And looking at ITE data, given the fact that no additional beds were proposed as part of this.
Yeah, I know ITE. ITE bases their parking requirements on more than just beds. Primarily, it's on outpatient space, which the hospital has increased over the years tremendously.
So there's about 50 studies and examples in the ITE for parking generation for hospitals. All of them, except for 2, are based upon beds or employee count. Okay?
Oh, I've seen it on outpatient, but that's... But the fact is that there's an existing site plan with a parking schedule already.
That wasn't submitted as part of this. Do you know where that exists or what when it was submitted?
Copy of it should exist downstairs, but I would imagine that the hospital also has a copy of the own site plan and parking schedule that they produced when they expanded the parking lot towards the intersection of Seymour Avenue and Division Street. I'm sure somebody could dig it out.
Do we have that available?
And, you know, in addition to that, I know that you've created much additional
parking. Public hearing's closed. The public hearing's closed.
He cannot commit. If this had been brought up okay. in the public hearing, we would have responded. Unfortunately, because the public hearing was closed, we can't respond. No. And we did respond at the last public hearing.
No.
Any more discussion? If not, all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay, motion carries. Move on to the next item, 11A. Informal discussion, 11A, Planning and Zoning Subcommittee Report on Application Procedures. Bill, you got the floor.
So, Big news is that we met with Kevin White, and he had been tasked with reviewing the site plan application that we put together. And what he came up with is, I'm going to call it a pre-application checklist for the novice applicant. Most of the applications Kevin gets involved in are from people who are not in the business of creating site plans. So they come in and they don't necessarily know what it is they have to do. And we hand them a 12-page document that says you need to come up with a lot of things. So what Kevin did is he boiled that down to the essentials. And so that's the document that we would give to an applicant if they'd never filed an application before. And it asks for the fundamental basic things, which can be the expensive things as well, and would serve as a precursor to filing the formal application and going through the expenses and the requirements to get to that point. And hopefully it also would weed out a lot of the, I'll call them turnbacks, the bumps in the road you get as you're going through the process of answering all the myriad bunches of questions that need to be answered. So we're going forward. We're going to meet in 2 weeks. And we're going to finalize this pre-application checklist with the goal of bringing it before this commission with a complete discussion and a presentation to implement it in June so that Kevin can start and at least Kevin and Lisa would be handing out this pre-application document to applicants as they come in. And we think it'd be a significant savings in time for him. It'll also be a great communication vehicle to the public. So that's the next thing we're going to do. And then we're working on the revisions to the existing forms that we have. I'll call them the more complicated forms. We're going to try and get those in a shape that we can use them on an interim fashion, and allow people to go through the process of filling these things out. So they'll be doing the pre-checklist beforehand, and then we'll guide them through the extended application. And then be able to move on from there and hope to have a much more streamlined process.
Exactly. I think it's going to streamline it and update our process going in and bring us into the 21st century here.
So the big news will be we expect to have something that can be implemented and start to be used next month. And we'll be bringing it to everybody here to look at. And then we can go forward.
So, in the beginning, I wanted to say a few words, but we kind of got off to a bumpy start with the technology. But anyway, I'd like to say it now why Bill's here. So we talked about it, I believe it was last month, but this will be Bill's last meeting on the commission. He's going to be moving. Bill obviously retired, and he's been on for the last few months. So I just want to say, Bill, thank you very much for what you're doing. Number one, number two, he's going to stay with us on the subcommittee to, follow this process all the way to the finish line, which is much appreciated. But,
you know, I just want to say thank you on behalf of the commission. Oh,
appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions about the subcommittee for 11A? Or any other questions?
Just a couple things. I sent a note to Al. Just a couple suggestions that I had on the submission guidelines and minor stuff. But I would also encourage Brian. I may talk to you offline about a couple of these that, you know, just want to make sure they're not running afoul of any statutory requirements.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I'll take a review. We could review it from a technical standpoint after it gets to that point.
Any other questions? If not, we'll move on. We'll move on to 11B, 35 Bellevue Drive, three lots with single driveway.
This is. I just had a comment, and I think Mark kind of mentioned this, and maybe Brian can weigh in on this. But there's no such thing as an informal discussion. Court cases have said that the process that goes on here is certainly part of the process of a reviewing an application. And we will be held, you know, in an ideal world, it would be nice. The applicant wants to know what we're thinking, how we can meet the regulations. And we want to try to help them. However, there's a, unfortunately, that's not the world we live in. Maybe Brian, you could speak
of that. I would agree with that. I think there is a process for pre-application meetings, but that's typically held with staff, not the full board. So I would agree that I don't think it's in anyone's interest, including the applicants, to have a proceeding as informal as tonight might be, that might allow a neighbor or someone who has an interest in the application to argue that there was one, either some technical violation of public notice or some predetermination of the application. So if in fact this is anticipated to be an application in the future, I think the best recommendation would be, as Paul and Mark had noted, to set up a meeting with staff, myself, planner, zoning enforcement officer, whoever might be appropriate, to review your application and provide technical comments on it. And then you'd be in a position to file a formal application with the board. But I don't think this board is in a position to give an informal opinion or informal advice. That's just not something that is appropriate.
Okay, I don't even know what, you know.
When I saw the agenda, I wasn't sure what the app, but it looks like it's a preliminary subdivision map of some sort. Is that?
Yes.
Hello, Kevin. I think the best course, again, we're happy to do it in person, over the phone, you know, with staff, but not actually the board, any members of the board, I should say. And we've done that for other applications as well.
So be it. Right, Ryan, do you have an opinion?
I'll defer to Brian, but I mean, would it be appropriate for Kevin to speak regarding what his discussions with the owner or whoever's?
Yes, it would. Yeah.
So maybe if Kevin, as staff, could address the commission regarding this, rather than a prospective applicant or owner or whatever, maybe that might be. Would that be appropriate? Or just so they can. Just asking the question.
You would have to come to us anyway. Even if an applicant goes and speaks with staff, they're going to have to come to the board.
Well, the applicant's going to have to come before the board.
Right.
But I think even Kevin would be best either put down in a letter or made part of the record of a formal application.
What would the procedure be then for a pre-application discussion with the commission? Is there such a thing?
Well, we've had them on some of the bigger applications, Summit Hill, for instance, where we've met, right? I think.
No, I'm talking about with the commission. Is there a possibility for a pre-application meeting with the commission?
Not with the commission.
Yeah.
Particularly on something that we This is a subdivision or a re-subdivision? Most likely a re-subdivision?
Yes.
Yeah, right, Kevin? It's a re-subdivision? So that
yes.
typically requires a public hearing. So I would be reluctant. If it was a site plan, I might be a little bit more open to having some input from Kevin tonight, but if it's actually going to require a public hearing, which I think it would, I think it would be best not opening that door. I mean, Kevin, if you want to give if there's a general question or explanation, comment that you...
Well, I think what we've... As we spoke about 5 minutes ago, we're trying to interpret written words that sometimes are held to the strictest definition and in other times perhaps not. And in this particular case, there is language in our subdivision or actually our zoning regulations that says that there's only two lots that can be utilizing a common driveway for all intents and purposes. This particular thought is to try for three lots, and would the applicant be wasting his time and monies and energies to pursue that, or is it dead in the water?
Well, I mean, I understand that scenario. I think the difficulty is the commission's really not going to be in a position to answer that. I think, Kevin, you, I, and Ryan could probably give an interpretation of that regulation. I'm not familiar with it off the top of my head. I'd have to review it, but I'd be happy to do so and speak with the applicant or his attorney, their attorney, consult with Ryan. I think ultimately this commission may look to their staff for input anyway. That's part of the public hearing process. Yeah. And of course, they're ultimately the deciders of their own regulations, but that would be my suggestion.
Well, I hope that between Brian, Ryan, Kevin, I hope you guys can speak with the potential applicant and guide him in the right direction so he doesn't spend his hard-earned money and then come here or have a different view of it and have that time, money, and energy wasted. So sure. Hopefully we could get an interpretation of it, get a decision, and then move forward.
Yeah, be happy.
That's one thing I don't know personally what the regulation is off the top of my head either. But hopefully we could get something together that says, listen, this is going to work or it's not going to work before he makes a decision or they make a decision. You know what I mean? I just don't want to see somebody waste months and time and money and prints and engineering and all that and then it not be able to work anyway. It's just something I want to entertain.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would agree with that. And I think we could certainly provide the applicant with our interpretation and then the applicant decide whether they agree with it or not, or if even or whether they want to pursue their application and
that's right,
because they have a right to file their application.
Correct.
They agree with us or not,
that's right. Yeah, it'll be in his court though at the time,
yeah,
and he'll be able to make an educated decision on.
Okay. And then I just will say this as well, just so the commission understands what the logic of this is. Section 2.2 of the subdivision regulations has a section called informal consideration. It says the commission recommends that prior to subdivision of a formal application for approval of a subdivision or resubdivision, the applicant prepare and present a preliminary plan of the subdivision or resubdivision for informal consideration by the commission. Presentation of a preliminary plan is recommended to facilitate general consideration of factors and problems affecting development of the land to be subdivided or resubdivided before the applicant proceeds with formal application and the preparation of final maps, plans, and documents required for formal consideration by the commission. So that language is in the subdivision regs. Now, I don't know that the format in which this appears in the agenda would support that or not, but
you have a map in front of you tonight, gentlemen, or did it not get up there?
Yes, I have it.
So would that document be what Ryan just spoke about?
Well, if I may, Kevin, I think it does. And thank you, Ryan, for bringing that section to my attention. But it, and I use this term commission, but I would, again, interpret that broadly to mean commission staff as opposed to the commission itself. I mean, I don't.
Okay. I guess we're all just trying to fill our way across the universe here and figure out what we tell these people when they come in. So a lot of times the advice that we're giving him is maybe not what the commission is looking for, or sometimes maybe not even get.
Well, that's true, Kevin. We can't speak for the commission, but I think I think we do have the capacity as staff to interpret the regulations. Okay.
All right. I'm not arguing. I'm just trying to clear up the definitions, I guess.
I think it's not only the position that it puts the commission in when we don't have a formal application, because court cases have said that our comments and the direction we give the applicant is going to, the courts are going to hold us to that as part of the formal review process. The other thing too is, what if I'm a neighbor? What if I'm a neighbor immediately adjacent the proposed subdivision, and the determination is made over whether or not the design is appropriate, and because we're informally looking at it, and we're going to say, yeah, it maybe if we say yes, that looks good, and then the neighbor says, I never had a chance to testify, I never had a chance to comment on the application. So
he would add it the next step.
Not yes, but Kevin, what if we tell them now, yeah, the three lots look okay, and the applicant comes in and we deny him. And you said at the informal thing, well, you said it was okay. Now the neighbor comes in and complains.
Well, you still got to go through the process. Yeah. But if, in my opinion, if we have the regulation and this doesn't even meet it, and everybody's like, oh, I don't even think that, I'm just using a hypothetical, that doesn't even meet that, I don't even see a way to get from A to B. Well, now that's his decision on if he brings it or not. But with coming in blind, he's going to do what the next steps are before he even gets there, where he doesn't have the opinion of anything. He's got to make a decision off of something. And that's the reason why he's coming to the board to start the application process, the public hearing and all that. There's nothing that's guaranteed there, but at least he knows he can make an educated decision on what his steps are. That's my opinion on it.
I think the informal discussion item should have been worded differently. It shouldn't mention any particular property. It should have been three flag lots with a single driveway.
Gotcha.
Informal discussion on the possibility of doing that, rather than a particular piece of property. And I think that's where Brian is coming from and Paul is coming from.
Yeah,
that this is very specific.
And we had things previously where we did that type of description. And it wasn't, it was too general too. So, you know,
it's
a catch 22 here, I guess.
Well, it's just difficult with any public.
Just do the best we could for the people in the town, you know.
And there are competing interests, but unfortunately, I think we're stuck with the, regardless of what our own regulations say, I think we're stuck with the public hearing process or something like this.
Yeah.
So it would be very, as I said, we're certainly, and I would invite the property owner to, you know, consult with staff, and we can certainly provide, you know, our interpretation. And ultimately, it's up to the commission as part of the application process. But I think we might be able to let you know whether we agree with you or not.
But I think okay, so we'll move on to 11C. 115 Olivia Street, the convenience store in the CDD zone.
Is there an applicant there tonight with you guys?
No.
No.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'm more than happy to meet with staff. Who do I contact?
Kevin.
Okay, and I can meet with the attorney and the planner.
Yeah, Kevin also will set that all up.
We'll set it up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Is there anyone here from a little? Oh, you're with him. I don't think. Is there anybody here for 115 Olivia Street? No. No. There's no one here, Kev.
Okay. Is there a drawing? Did Lisa bring something up for you?
Yes.
Sound like got a it right vellum.
Here. It's a.
Yeah. So it kind of goes back to where we were last month, where there's a non-conforming. Well, it actually is an older building at one point that was a bunch of things in its history. I actually remember back in the 50s and 60s that it was a small little convenience store. Through the years, it's been
an
upholstery shop, a couple of other things that I'm aware of. It's vacant now. There's a couple of apartments upstairs. The gentleman that owns the place wants to reopen the downstairs back to the convenience store. It fits in the CDD zone, but the bugaboo on all these is the parking issues with no parking at all on Olivia. He's not within the 300 feet of the parking garage. And again, we want to talk to him. Should he go forward with this application, put in a formal application, or is it something that, we're really not interested in, as the vape shop around the corner was snuck in about a year and a half ago. So that's why it's on the agenda tonight.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Can this fall along the same lines of what we just were talking about?
Pretty much.
We're bringing something to the table that we shouldn't be bringing to the table. Am I correct, Brian? If this applicant wants to sit down with staff, so be it. But
this was already a use, though.
Well, it's very similar, yes. I think the only distinction, I think Kevin may be looking for some direction here from the board as opposed to an applicant. And it also appears to be more of a site plan application that's really not a public hearing. But I'm not sure, Kevin, do you have a specific question for the commission as opposed to on a regulation as opposed to this particular property?
Is the creation of the CDD zones in downtown years ago the thought of where the additional parking was ever going to be generated from in all of these areas in the downtown area? Or is it not to be considered?
I guess it's a question here, or it's a question related to properties that may not technically comply with the parking requirements under CDD?
Yes.
Is there a waiver provision in our regulations regarding parking downtown?
There's provisions for waiving parking when you're within 300 feet of a municipal parking facility, either garage or surface parking lot.
So
he's just thought of that.
It's kind of close.
But is the question, Kevin, more related to the historical non-conforming nature or the historical use, whether or not this is a continuation?
No, of it's the historical nature of the non-conforming use.
Okay, so what? Give us the history as you understand it.
Well, like I said,
what was it most recently?
Upholstery repair shop, but it hasn't been that in 10 years.
Upholstery repair,
at least.
It was a barber shop too.
Barber shop. But the property has always been a commercial use, is what you're saying.
Yes.
And it's currently vacant.
Yes.
And so it never changed to your knowledge. It never changed to another use. It was either a commercial
not
use
to my knowledge. No.
Use.
So it was an upholstery shop, and they want to make it a convenience store.
Back to a convenience store that it was way back.
Not in anybody's recent memory.
It was before the flood.
You who said that? Mark? Is that you, Mark?
455?
It's never a convenience. Well, I know the owner of the property. It was never a convenience. barbershop.
It was a barbershop. That's where I used to get my hair cut.
Stone and I used to live right by there. The Roses.
But it's always been, it most recently has been commercial and just vacant.
Yes.
So it's not conforming with respect to parking.
I think Brian and Ryan should look up the history, get the facts, and then I think we should find out the history first, and then we could, you know, the staff can go forward and give you their best opinion on what should be done once we know the history and where to go from there.
Well, okay. Kevin, are there any other uses in this building?
Just apartments upstairs.
How many?
Two. I'm going to say that I believe there's two. I did not go into the building.
Oh, okay. Well, need to know.
It looks, again, generally speaking, it looks as if this might be a pre-existing non-conforming use, but it's also a determination as to whether the new proposed, the proposed use is different in kind from what was existing there before. And now that's an argument the applicant's going to have to demonstrate that it's not different from the prior uses. Because you can continue a non-conforming use, but you cannot change a non-conforming use.
Right, that's what we had last.
So the use is permitted in the zone. The question is the nature of the non-conforming parking. So if it increases the parking demand,
then it
causes a problem. If you go from one use that has a higher parking demand that's non-conforming to a lower parking demand, you've decreased the non-conformity.
Correct.
If vice versa happens, if you go from what's a use with no parking,
to a convenience store.
Yeah, upholstery shop to a convenience store. Upholstery shop probably has a very low parking demand. A convenience store clearly has a higher parking demand. Well, we should have to check it within the context of the regulations, of course. But, you know, whether or not an upholstery store is a separate and distinct use from a convenience store in the regulations would sort of define whether or not it is a change.
Right. That's absolutely correct. Because the nonconformity may not be the use itself, but the inability to have sufficient parking for that related
correct.
To that.
Correct. Correct. Correct.
So I think you guys will figure out what the best the history is and go forward and give Kevin your opinion.
Absolutely.
Right, because if the opinion at the end of the day, the procedure would be if the opinion of the zoning enforcement officer is that this increases the parking demand, and therefore it's an increase in the existing nonconformity, the applicant has the right to go to the zoning board of appeals to petition that the zoning board of appeals to contest the determination of the zoning enforcement officer or seek a variance.
Correct.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
If there's no other questions, we'll move on to 11D, potential additional special exemption use in the I-1 zone. That's in your
yes. Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Sure.
Go ahead, Mayor. Thank you. So this is a proposed amendment to the I-1 zone to specify a use that currently may not be, or certainly is not expressly listed within the zone, arguably could fall within some of the stated uses, but we felt that rather than create some potential for misinterpretation or expansion or stretching the current interpretation of, for instance, a warehouse use within that zone, that it would be best to draft a specific regulation that would allow the proposed use, the two uses actually, the redemption center and
basically a metal reclamation center for collection, storage, and sorting of metal, ferrous and non-ferrous. The impetus for this particular reg change, as you may have guessed, has to do with the Rubino facility down on 2 Factory Street. The city is in the process of closing the purchase of that property. We're under contract to purchase. I believe we were before this board for an 8-24 approval back in October or November of last year. The acquisition was approved, also approved by the Board of Aldermen. As part of that, process, the city is entering into a relocation agreement with the current tenant, Rubino Brothers, to relocate them within to a new location within the city of Derby. And again, given the current regulations in the I-1 zone, it wasn't clear that the use would be permitted, currently permitted within the I-1 zone, unless you really tried to shoehorn it into a particular provision. So rather than do that, we felt it was appropriate for this commission to consider a regulation that would specifically allow the Rubino Brothers' use within the I-1 zone. And I want to make it clear what this regulation does not allow. It is not allowing a junkyard within the I-1 zone. There were some technical changes to the existing definition of junk, a new definition proposed to make everything consistent. Same with junkyard. A junkyard includes a motor vehicle junk business, a motor vehicle junkyard. Those terms are specifically defined within the general statutes, and there's specific licenses that an operator needs to obtain as part of that to run a motor vehicle junk business, a motor vehicle junkyard. Rubino Brothers is not that type of operation. It's a very limited operation, again, for the collection, sorting, and temporary storage of metals for recycling. So basically, they take the material in and then ship it down to their facility in Stamford for the true processing of the recycling. So in order for us to fulfill our obligations under the relocation agreement, again, we need to find a location within the city of Derby to move them. They are currently pre-existing non-conforming use, so they have every right to remain where they are and continue to operate, which obviously, given the downtown redevelopment that's proposed, location is not ideal. There have been a few locations identified within the I-1 zone that we feel would be appropriate for this type of operation. It does require that the operation be conducted within a building, but also does allow some percentage of outside storage as well. And it's defined, it's not allowed everywhere within the I-1 zone. If you look at the regulation, it's it can't be a pre-existing non-conforming lot in the I-1 zone. It has to comply with the I-1 lot area regulations of 40,000 square feet. But there's also a cap on the square footage, so it can't be a giant operation. It can't be more than 80,000 square feet in area. So you're eliminating a lot of lots where it's possible. It also needs to be basically adjacent or close by a railroad right-of-way. So there are certain areas in town where that's appropriate. I think you're mostly familiar with those. So we felt that was appropriate to limit to specific areas in town where the use was consistent with other uses in that particular I-1 zone properties. It also specifically excludes motor vehicle recyclers, businesses, or yards, which again are defined in the general statutes and are more a more intensive use that would not be appropriate in our opinion for the city of Derby. So those are not allowed. That doesn't change. It's really just allowing the existing non-conforming use to relocate from what's no longer an appropriate location within the city of Derby to a location that is appropriate. And the redemption center part, we felt we should just tackle that as well. As you may recall, there was an application or a proposed application a few months ago that was ultimately not submitted or withdrawn. But it had us thinking, staff thinking that it might be appropriate use in the I-1 zone. And the redemption center is defined again in under the DEEP regulations. And it simply allows, as you might suspect, a bottle return center. I mean, it's not a highly intensive use and not much more than happens at at your local Big Y or shopping center. But it would be primarily indoor within a warehouse. It's a processing center. So I'm happy to answer any questions. But again, this is all in conjunction with our the city's redevelopment of downtown to move the pre-existing non-conforming use to a more appropriate location. I should also note that one of the other things that the applicant does, or not the applicant, but the that typically occurs at these types of facilities, is that they do take in automobile batteries. They're not processed, but they take them in for recycling at other locations. So it's basically, again, an interim stop in the reuse of these products. So that we discussed including that specific in the that specific element of recycling within this definition. But I think the conclusion was that it might be better off just when the applicant comes in, if they want to undertake that use, to just include it within their statement of use and in their site plan. It would all be indoor storage, essentially warehousing.
Not according to language here. Where did you come up with the calculation for 150% outdoor storage based on the size of the building for the recycling center? And then for the redemption center, the outdoor storage can't exceed the size of the building.
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, it's essentially a practical definition. If you're familiar with the current pre-existing there's significant outdoor storage, and it's a function of the use. I mean, there has to be.
Well, I'm also very familiar with the recycling center in Watertown off of exit 37 in Watertown. That's a big recycling center. It's all indoor storage. Driving by, going through there, you would never know that it is indoor recycling center. And it's the same type of material that's being used down here. It seems like it's the same as a junkyard, except the automotive parts part of it is being eliminated. And it's not just one property, one industrial zone property in Derby that would qualify.
No, there's a few.
Two other ones offhand. Based on the criteria for eligibility.
Well, that is true. There's not limited to one property because
there's more industrial zone properties.
Right.
Yeah.
But it is limited to properties that we feel would be appropriate for this use. And it's
so the 150% came about because that's what's down there now.
I would say it's more outside storage at the current location than that.
That building is small.
Yeah. Ryan and I did a calculation, and we think it's,
if you get a 10,000 square foot building, you're allowed 15,000 square feet,
which is only only a quarter acre.
Yeah, I know, but that's a lot of junk outside.
Well, it's not. It is, but it's not. I mean, it's it's not.
I mean, it's unsightly no matter
how. It's unsightly. There's no, it's an intensive industrial use. There's no question
about it. If you have 150% of the building, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
So this, maybe we should look at that so that we make the indoor facility more bigger. If they want to gain more outside space, then they could put more stuff. I'm just talking.
The other practical part, you know, problem with that, Brian, is who's going to go down there and measure it out to calculate how much of the property is being used for outdoor storage? And I just think that that's...
Well, you wouldn't be able... It would be the total property.
No.
Why not?
No, say it's a 3-acre parcel.
Okay.
Okay. Which is 120,000 square feet.
Well, it's not allowed to be a 3-acre parcel.
Yeah.
It's only allowed to be a 2-acre, 80,000.
80,000. Okay. Yeah. Say it's a 2-acre. Well, then say it's a 2-acre parcel.
Okay. Well, you still have to kind of comply with the site plan requirements for the building. And, you know, so it's
I would think it's a fairly easy thing to enforce.
It's not going to be.
Well,
that.
That's what I mean. You're not going
to submit a site plan without site drawing shown.
Right.
There is appropriate screening. And which the other factor is the city is using grant money to build this building.
So if you had 80,000 square feet, right, for two, because that's the max, right?
Right.
And what's 150% of that minus that? That would be your total outside space that would leave you left over the building plus the setbacks and all that.
I think, Gino, it's 150%. Of the size of the building.
That's what right. I mean.
So if you had a small building, you could have a
slightly larger outside storage. That's what I'm getting.
But if you start,
just for instance, I mean, basically, we anticipate this building, and there's plans for this building,
okay,
to be under 10,000 square feet. It's I should have it. It's 20. It's bright.
What's he doing?
7,200.
It was about between 7,000 and 8,000 square feet. But if you use 10,000 for rough math, you've got
13,000 feet outside.
15,000
space. Feet. Space is all determined on what, how much metal is he going to push through there.
So that's a quarter.
So if he's reducing it all to powder, it's a different thing than if he's just breaking it into pieces and chopping it up to send it off to a smelter or whatever.
It has to do with ferrous and non-ferrous metals.
I get that. So I'm just saying, what's he doing in the building?
They're storing the non-ferrous metals in the building.
Aluminum, copper, things that are real valuable. Things that you don't, that could be stolen.
So I get that, but and then he's just a waypoint to ship it to a
correct
smelter.
Correct.
He's sending it to a transformer, whatever. That's what they're doing.
Right? Correct.
He's just an intermediary step to break this thing. So I would be more concerned about what are you doing with all the fluids that come in the cars?
There are no cars.
There's no cars.
What's this automotive?
No.
And equipment, machinery, equipment, motor vehicles.
No, that's the definition of junkyard. The junkyards are specifically not allowed.
Yeah,
those are the prohibited.
So there's no fluids. There's no.
No.
It's
got batteries. What about lithium batteries?
Yeah, there could be.
Lithium batteries are starting to become more prevalent now.
I just did a big demo on lithium ion batteries. Can't put them out. There's a few new products that are out there that does put them out. They're a big issue. Big issue.
I just wanted, I mean, I just make it notes like that. Boron is another material that's starting to pop up now. Magnesium, titanium, that's starting to show up in automotive now. So I'll point out magnesium and titanium in powder form are explosives, right? It's been in fireworks out of.
Is there going to be anything outside that's going to be underneath a covering? Or is it just going to be open air on the outside for his storage area?
Well, we haven't seen the site plan yet, but the anticipation would be that there would be open outside storage.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this is Vince McDermott. I've been on the line here.
Go ahead, Vince. How you doing?
I'm fine. One of the limiting factors, and I don't have the regulation in front of me, Ryan May, is that in this zone, there is a total ground area coverage requirement as well.
There's so,
coverage requirement. I don't remember what it is, but that would certainly begin to limit some of the exposure that I'm hearing some concern about.
So lot coverage is defined as the portion of the lot that is covered by buildings and structures.
Right.
So it's
right.
not like parking, it's not included.
Right.
Not,
says only 60%.
Yeah.
I should also
point out 80,000 square foot lot. Maximum building you could put on here is 48,000 square feet.
Good math.
It's also by special exception. So this board would be able to impose the requirements that it felt appropriate, for instance, you know, limiting the type of batteries that could be there. I mean, it is right now, it's, they said automobile batteries. I interpreted that to be your diehard.
Yes.
Battery, not a Tesla lithium battery. And we can impose those conditions.
They might not even accept them either in their regulation, you know, as their business model.
Right. Whatever. So this is a special exception. You're going to be, and as well as a site plan application. So you're going to have, it's just permitting the use subject to a special exception. So you're going to have input into the design of the building, layout.
What other properties are there that meet this requirement next to the train track and all that besides?
There's Commerce Street. There's one down
behind BJ's.
Water Street. Commerce Court behind BJ's. I think that's about it. Okay. Just Water Street behind BJ's and Commerce.
Okay.
I don't think the ones on Derby Milford Road approach the railroad track close enough to meet the special exception requirements that we put in the regulation. I'd like to correct one thing I said before when I was responding to Vince's question about coverage. The I-1 zone says maximum lot coverage 60%, including all outdoor storage. So I said that it did not include outdoor storage, but the I-1 language does include outdoor storage as part of the coverage requirement.
I thought that was the case, Ryan.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Raymond.
Brian, is the city prepared to apply for the text change?
Well, this was the first step in the application process. This board would be adopting the regulation, and it would be similar to what we did with vape shops.
They wanted to see if we would entertain it before they spent their money.
So we would be the applicant on behalf.
Well, it's going to be submitted by the city, by staff, just as we did with the vape shops and the other application. So this is basically before we sent it out to Valley Cog and published the notice. We wanted to have this discussion, since technically this board is the one, this commission is the one adopting it. So.
David, go ahead, Brian. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
You know, I'm reading that.
Brian.
Would have been appropriate to actually come up with a definition
of a reclamation center. And within that definition, we could itemize exactly what kind of materials that they're able to accept. I'm looking here and it's saying collection, sorting, temporary storage. What's temporary? And shipping of used reclaimable metal, including both ferrous and non-ferrous, for recycling. The way I read this, it's only the ferrous and non-ferrous metals that are allowed to go in there. There's nothing about batteries or things of that nature that could go in there, anything that could be toxic.
Well, the only...
Go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt, but that's correct. I mean, it's very limited in what's allowed. And as I said, the applicant but Rubino does currently store and transport the car batteries. So they did ask for that to be specifically listed, and I would suggest that it should be added to avoid your concerns or address those concerns. But it is a very, very narrow type of material.
So. Yeah.
And it mirrors the definition under the state statutes for scrap metal processor, which is for But it's even more narrow than that because it's preparing iron, steel, and non-ferrous metals into a form suitable. So that's also a very narrow definition. And ours, Vince, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think our use is even narrower than a scrap metal processor because we're really just a temporary, and you're right, temporary could be
years.
Temporary doesn't mean it's not a landfill, so it's not going to be there forever. And plus, this material has value, so it's going to always be the material there. And you're right, you're not going to know whether this piece of metal's been there for a week or a year, but it's a business where it's going
their
to
income
be,
generates on how much they bring in and how much.
Well, it also depends on the market price.
Correct. Yeah.
For these metals, that's why you'll see stuff hanging on there for a long, long time, because the owners are waiting until the price of that particular metal goes up.
Until it pays for the fuel to ship it from A to B.
But in a sense, that may be to our advantage as a community, because to the extent that material is static and remains there for a long period of time, they only have limited storage. So they're not going to be bringing new material in and processing. So it's even going to be a less intense use, I would argue, than
that's not their business model.
Yeah, that's not their business model. They're
moving metal as well.
Yeah, exactly. So
I look at the price of rebirth.
Is there any requirement for height? I know there's a couple pieces of property I have in mind that are down deep and they can go up quite high.
35.
Well, is there 35 feet in there? Is that what it says?
35 feet.
And that's for the outdoor storage? Or building height?
That's building height.
Oh, my question was for outdoor storage.
Ah, well, that's interesting.
Well, I mean,
because I know that, I know it might not be their benefit, but you could go up pretty high. Yeah. You ever see those cranes down in New Haven?
Well, I mean,
I don't know if it meets the business model, but you don't want to be higher than, some other roads that might be driving by either.
Well, I think we could. I certainly have no problem putting a height limitation on outside storage. I think
maybe it's something that you guys could look into to see if anybody does that or if it's,
Well, again, you do have it is a special exception approval. So when this commission acts on any special exception use, it has the ability to impose conditions on the use. So, for instance, landscaping. Hours of operation,
height of
outdoor storage, location of outside storage. Those things are all within your police powers to protect, make sure that the use, even though it's allowed, is appropriate.
Again, what's appropriate screened? Without a definition for that, I could see an argument ensuing. But David, you're the one at the time of the hearing that determines what it's appropriate. And it's your call. Yeah, I wish it was that cut and dry.
You're talking about the height?
No. Screening around outdoor storage.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Is it trees? Is it fencing? Is it?
Well, it may be for some of the properties I'm thinking of, some of them already may have a natural buffer on it. Mm-hmm. So you may want a fence on the street side, but not necessarily on the back side if there's a natural buffer. So appropriate, I think, gives this again this board discretion, particularly in the context of your site plan regulations as to what.
I just wish that we had a standard to follow with that.
But if you had a standard and you wanted to impose something more, you're in a more difficult position. If you leave it appropriate, five members of this commission voting determine what's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, this is a regulation that this particular use is very narrow, so it's not as obnoxious as some other uses that deal with waste material. And this, again, we don't consider it to be waste. necessarily
reclaimable product,
reclaimable metal. So it's not waste. So it's a very narrow definition. And again, it's the type of thing that if it's not allowed somewhere, it's going to remain where it is. So
I don't know of any other towns that would take it in like that.
Mr. Chairman.
Almost every town in the state of Connecticut has a prohibition.
Go ahead, Raymond.
I think, just my opinion, but Brian's going back and forth on these things, and you have the state statutes out there. I'm sure this business has to be licensed by the state. There's got to be certain things there that they got to adhere to.
Yep.
And that being said, along with the preliminary definition that he has here, I would say move forward with this, take into consideration some of the things we just mentioned, and come up with a draft to come before us again next month or what have you. Take it from there.
That was going to be my next question. What's our next step in the process, Brian?
Well, again, Vince and Brian could jump in, but I think we're comfortable with this definition. I would add the automobile batteries just to be clear that that's going to be allowed. And again, it's special exception, so you would be able to require that they would have to show where the batteries are being stored within the building interior. You could limit the area, those types of things. But other than that, I think we drafted the regulation. We're comfortable with it. I don't know if there are any specific changes. Again, things like outdoor height, I think, is a good comment. But I would suggest that could be utilized as part of the special exception process. Or if the commission would prefer, we could easily add a line that says, height of outside storage shall not exceed, we already say not greater than 150% of the area. We could add a not higher than the height of the building. I think that would be
or not higher than the tallest fence. It's outside.
Yeah. Well, the fencing, I think the fencing, you're only going to have the height of the fence is only 8 feet, right? I think we ran into that at ZBA, 8 or 10 feet. So
I'd like to maybe research the height. So let just for instance, there's only certain size equipment that they're going to be able to, it'll be cost effective for them. So if their quote unquote hypothetical crane only goes up 25 feet in height, but the next biggest thing got to come on 3 tractor trailers to build it there to make 35 or 40, then I think maybe we rethink that total height thing. And maybe we curtail it to something that's reasonable. If we say 25 feet, but 25 feet is nothing compared to where this lot is, you know, or these potential lots, I just don't want to, you know, put a stipulation that's either way out of whack or way under some research.
How does their outdoor storage get today?
Anyone pretty high.
It's probably like 25 feet, 20 feet. It goes over the building. You could see it from the road.
Hmm.
And that pile has been, you know, it gets there, but they're small though. They're condensed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So if you can't spread out 3 different piles, in my opinion, you put 1 big pile, right? Because you only got so much area. So that's why I would want to kind of just look into that before we say, oh, no, you could only go up 15 feet. And that's not, then we have, you know, 100 piles of 15 feet high instead of 1
pile. Mr. Chairman, the thing with the height of that, whatever it is, pile or whatever, I think the wording in here appropriately screened from the public view gives us leeway when we see a site-specific site plan.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if it's a flat pancake lot in the middle of a prairie, mm-hmm. you're going to see it for miles.
Yeah.
But given the topography of the piece of property that I think people know about, or any of them around here, I mean, it is, we got the valley hills and stuff like that. So that's going to be, I think that should be dealt with at the time when we have a, you know, topography, a topographic map or what have you.
I agree. I think
I think what I'm hearing is the consensus is that we'll move to the next step and keep the ball moving.
We would like to move on an expedited basis because those things are moving quickly as far as the transaction goes. And you know, Rubino is in the process of identifying some properties that might fit their needs, and they want to move forward as well. So, you know, I think if this board is ready, we'll get it ready for submission for a formal application.
Ryan, your opinion?
So when it comes to the application, you know, as the case with any zone change, a zone text amendment, notice must be provided to regional councils of government. Mm-hmm. They have 35 days to issue a report about the intermunicipal impacts. From a notice requirement, the only notice requirements for legal notice is that it goes in the paper 2 weeks and then 1 week before the public hearing. Mm-hmm. So in theory, we could gather an application, get it submitted over the next week or so, and be in a position to open a public hearing next month. It's a possibility. That doesn't mean the commission has to act on it.
Right.
You have no statutory requirement or time limit to act on a self-created text amendment.
Mm-hmm.
I would caution that if drastic changes or significant changes to the regulation occur during the course of the public hearing process, then it would be appropriate to re-notify the COGS if there's a substantive change, yeah. If it's just a minor change item.
Understood. Any other comments or questions or concerns from the commission? Raymond?
Move on to payment of bills.
Okay.
Brian, do you want to do something? I was just going to say, to recap, we can expect the application next month to be the same language, but just with the addition of batteries.
Yes, we'll take one more look on it and discuss it, but essentially I think that's where we are right now. If we have any other things
about. Okay, we'll move on to number 12, payment of bills. Can I get a motion to pay the bills if they are deemed correct?
So moved.
Raymond, second?
I'll second.
Joe, all in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay, then get a motion for adjournment.
Motion at adjourn.
8:25. Raymond? Second. Joe, all in favor? Thank you. Appreciate it. Have a good holiday.